Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Gold Belly. Gold Belly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Gold Belly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
It's the Fry-Yay Cocktail, presented by Anna Glavinsky.
Joining me on the line now, I have Preston Lauterbach. He's written a book that's called Before Elvis, The African-American Musicians Who Made the King. Preston, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm great. It's still tea time here. I'm not quite ready for my cocktail, but when the time comes, I will be.
What time is tea time? What is tea time? Are you talking having a cup of tea, having lunch? So I call it dinner or lunch.
I have a cup at about 10:30 in the morning, right about now.
So that to you is tea time.
It is.
Well, that is so far out, because the Welsh people I know would call tea time about 5 p.m. and that's when they have what I would call my dinner.
Well, I guess we're kind of mashing up our tea times here, because, you know, we're at my weird tea time and close to the Welsh, you know, acceptable tea time. So
I'm You're having what I would call 11sies.
Okay. Yes, definitely. I love my 11sies.
So it's like your tea and biscuit after your breakfast and before your lunch. Anyway, I feel like that is not the important topic of today's conversation. my first question is really, what inspired you to write the book Before Elvis? You know, was there a moment when you realized that this book needed to be written? What's the importance of it?
No doubt about it. I am a longtime Elvis fan. Elvis is kind of my Jesus when it comes to rock and roll and American culture. And so when the Elvis biopic came out here in America in 2022, I was kind of reluctant to go and see it, but a friend dragged me to it and said, "You're being ridiculous. Let's go check this out." I was so moved to see Elvis's Black musical influences highlighted. But then in reading some of the criticism of the film after I'd seen it, a lot of people thought that that was inadequate and really wanted to know more about these originators, like Big Mama Thornton, like Arthur Big Boy Crudup. Meanwhile, I've been researching African-American music history for the past 20 years. So I thought, oh, I could do that.
How hard can it be? tell me a little bit more about you. Who are you? What's your background? You say you've been researching that theme, that era for a while, but writing books. What's your background?
Right. Yeah. So Before Elvis is my seventh book. I began publishing in 2011 with a book called The Chitlin Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll, which was really the first book out of America anyway that traced rock and roll's roots through Black music. And my career kind of went in that direction from there. And I've been doing a number of Black history, Black music history projects ever since. So I've co-authored books with the gospel singing group, the Blind Boys of Alabama.
Yeah.
With the sister of the legendary blues man, Robert Johnson, and with a great Memphis soul drummer by the name of Howard Grimes. So that's what I've devoted my life to, is being able to tell those stories either through archival research or conducting my own interviews. You know, oftentimes the key figures are long gone by the time I'm interested in them. And so I have to find friends and family in order to fill in the gaps, or I find printed archival interviews, which I have to say, European researchers have been so critical. American people just haven't valued our music history and our cultural roots as much as European fans have. So European fans have done a tremendous amount of the research that I have put to work in all of my books. So I'm very appreciative to the love for American music that's over on the continent.
Wow, I had no idea. That's really interesting, actually.
And, no doubt
about. And what about it, you know, as a topic being received? You've been in this industry now for a long time. Do you, and you're writing about things that happened even way, way further back. What right. Do you think times are changing in being receptive to hearing about these sorts of stories? Because these stories also come with opinions, you know, and yeah. a look at things and emotions.
You're right about that. And that's where things get a little bit tricky. You know, I've been doing this for long enough to have been very well received with my first two books. I'm a white guy. I'm doing Black history. That in and of itself is potentially controversial, you know, really in the eye of the beholder. Some people are fine with it. Some people automatically question that. And of course, I will never experience racism firsthand. And so what I have had to do is to lean on authentic African-American sources. You know, I'm a journalist slash historian, so I know how to find the information. And of course, there is, you know, there's a deep well of Black journalism that I draw from, archival interviews with the real historic figures. But my first two books came out and I think, you know, did very well with Black audiences. These are in, you know, 2011 and 2015. Now, I feel like that could be changing. And I think it's probably a good thing. I think it probably means that there are more Black authors and Black writers who are speaking to the African-American audience. So I consider it a positive, but it has definitely changed over the course of my career.
Absolutely. And talking now specifically about the book, you know, about the musicians who shaped Elvis, who was credited really for sort of inventing rock and right. roll. But yes. you dispute that.
Well, I do. And Elvis would dispute it right along with me, and he would point to these exact same people. So it's certainly not an anti-Elvis type of a book. That's uh-huh. another question I get a lot. It's, well, is this a woke Elvis takedown? It's really not. I'm trying to see these great African-American musicians through Elvis's eyes and to figure out what it is about them that appealed to him. So he loved these artists and he credited people like Fats Domino. He repeatedly called Fats Domino, who's an African-American pianist from New Orleans, Louisiana, who started recording about 5 years before Elvis, as the real king of rock and roll.
Yeah.
Another of his influences, who I profiled in this book, another of Elvis's influences, was a man by the name of Arthur Kruda, who was an African-American blues musician who started making records back in the early 1940s and originated a song called "That's All Right, Mama." I believe his version, Arthur Kruda's version, came out in 1946. Well, that became Elvis's first hit. And in Elvis's early interviews, he always credited Crudup as being his favorite singer or being his inspiration. And at one point he said, "I knew as a young guy, if I could feel all that old Arthur felt, I'd be a music man like the world never saw." And so Elvis really connected with these artists on an emotional level. It wasn't simply, "Hey, this is a good song. I want to do this." It's the emotional depth and the feeling that these singers put across. And you can hear that influence in Elvis's renditions of Black originated recordings. Elvis is also a master of communicating various temperatures of emotion in subtle ways. Sometimes it's a deep breath. Sometimes it's a grunt. Sometimes it's a howl. You know, I mean, and I think he really developed that technique in learning in listening to Black artists.
So is that where you would say perhaps that he wasn't stealing? You know, there's this popular idea perhaps that Elvis was stealing Black music. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's an important conversation to have, and it's a big theme of the book. So on one level, we have appropriation, which is a white guy doing Black music, doing Black dance, dressing like an African-American, deriving really the main ingredients of his fame from African-American origination. I don't think there's any question about that. When it comes to really stealing and reaping financial rewards undeservedly, that's where there's a different villain, I think, to spotlight. Elvis is a very convenient lightning rod for these types of criticisms. One of the things I wanted to do with this book was to really get into the truth behind answering those questions. Well, did he really owe these artists money? And the fact is, getting back to that song I mentioned earlier, That's All Right, which was Elvis's first hit, originated by Arthur Big Boy Crudup. So Elvis's version, if you look at the record that his company issued, they very clearly credit Crudup as the composer, as they should have. And then I was able to find canceled checks that showed where Elvis's record company paid royalties to the copyright holder of That's All Right. Now, the problem lies in the fact that the copyright no longer was with the songwriter Arthur Crudup when Elvis was issuing royalties on the song. That song had already, the copyright and the publishing to that song had already been lost. And so these swindles that I think Elvis is credited for or blamed for really took place in the weeds of the music business. And so I really want for people to read the details of that and to really understand what happened. Yes, absolutely. Elvis got famous doing black music. Without black music, he would have been a country artist. You know, he would have been in that Grand Ole Opry hayride scene that was happening down south at the same time. So the black music was the ingredient that differentiated him from anything else. And that's why he's credited as the inventor of rock and roll. But as he himself would tell you, if he could, I think his quote in one of these early interviews was African-American people had been doing this for a long time. They just didn't get the publicity he did.
Yeah, and I think there's also a perception that Elvis was often a puppet himself. You know,
He was a victim to the exact same exploitation that happened to the African-American originators. Absolutely.
Yeah, so maybe he wasn't in that position of power to sort of create these injustices. He was just the poster boy of it.
I mean, think about him as a 19-year-old truck driver with a high school education. That's who he was when he started his career in music. He has absolutely, first of all, no thought of exploitation in his mind, nor any understanding of the way that these processes work. Now, as you read on through the book, you will see that I do criticize Elvis later in his career when I believe he could have done more on the behalf of his influences.
Are you able to give some examples of that or how you think that he evolved to maybe turn a blind eye? Or
I think that's part of it. I think that as he became, you know, I mean, the world's greatest superstar of all time, there's a certain amount of oddity and reclusiveness that comes with that experience. I think he certainly lost sight of his roots, as I think you might have said there. And these issues just weren't as important to him anymore. At the same time, in the early 1970s, when Elvis was touring, you know, we had great rock acts from the UK, primarily Led Zeppelin, Cream, they were touring, and quite often, oh, and the Stones as well did this. So, I mean, all of the high profile English rock acts that were touring the big American stadiums at that time, a lot of them brought African-American originators along as their opening acts. And they provided exposure for these artists. I mentioned earlier having co-written a book with Robert Johnson's sister. She always said, well, I have to thank and bless the British boys for keeping his name alive. And so there's a real great appreciation, you know, for all of those rock acts from across the pond that came over and brought exposure and knowledge of these roots artists. Well, Elvis could have done the exact same thing. I mean, there was a precedent for that. He had the knowledge. Certainly, he had the ability to make that what he wanted to do. And so the fact that he didn't rubs me a little bit the wrong way. I think he could have really helped folks out. And certainly, he had the ability to advocate for them when it came time for the proper payment of royalties, which was another issue.
Yeah, because he had that profile and he had that spotlight on him to be able to use a voice, I suppose. And I mean, what do you reckon if the industry had been a bit fairer back then, if things were a bit more equal, what do you think the history of rock and roll, do you think it would have played out differently? Do you think it would have evolved differently? How could you imagine things?
There's no other way for it to have happened. It's still an issue. When you think about, you know, the issue of Taylor's version, Taylor Swift here having to re-record her original music because she had lost ownership, I believe, of her master recordings. And so she was, again, just like some of these folks who who inspired Elvis. She was at one point a young, naive, inexperienced person who signed a contract that had certain stipulations in it that she eventually realized were not too good for her. But, you know, when you have a person who wants to make that first record and sees cash in hand, they're not going to think about the fine print. And so that type of exploitation has happened over. And I mean, even the moguls in America, people like Jay-Z, have lost copyrights, have lost publishing rights, have lost master recording ownership in dirty dealings, which are standard in the music industry. So it's really impossible to think about it happening any other way, simply because it's still going on.
That's true. That's true. But do you think in other ways, at least between sort of black and white music artists, yes, things have improved since then? How would you just describe looking at the music industry today through that lens compared to it back then?
The whole reason that Elvis appropriated this music is that black music, rhythm and blues at that particular time in the 1940s and the 1950s, it was this tiny little niche industry and part of American music. People didn't really know about it in the mainstream. It had such a small little fraction of the radio dial as people are, you know, turning their radio dials in their cars and their homes, finding what to listen to. Very little bit of that bandwidth was committed to black music. If you go into a record store in 1950, there was probably a little rhythm and blues section at the back in the corner. And the same goes for access to those early television dates. Not a lot of black artists were showcased on television. And so R&B was marginalized in that day. Now, it's the dominant force in American music. You look at Beyonce. I mean, she has done something that is I think on par with Elvis, with her Cowboy Carter project in terms of, you know, interpreting and synthesizing this huge American story and singing it through her music. I mean, it's really brilliant.
Yeah. And I've got another question. It's quite a big one as well. And just talking about sort of distribution of music as well, just like you were talking about there. Nowadays, it's so much easier to find and explore and look for the music that you want to listen to. It's not fed to us anymore. We have that power to sort of go and seek it out. So if listeners who've been listening to us today wanted to explore some of the music that inspired Elvis himself, you know, those original pioneers, where, yes, should they start?
Well, every track that I mentioned in the book, and it's an overview of African-American gospel, African-American blues, African-American R&B, African-American jazz, all of it. Every track that I reference in the book is available on YouTube. And I like YouTube because you may have to listen to an advertisement in order to get there, but everything is available and it is ultimately free. So you don't have to subscribe to anything. You don't have to purchase anything. In terms of the artists, you know, I would urge people to get out there and listen to someone like Junior Parker, who was the original writer and recording artist of the song Mystery Train, which a lot of people consider to be Elvis's finest work. Well, Junior Parker is this brilliant artist who Elvis thoroughly looked up to, who has a tremendous body of work from rockabilly style, you know, early rock and roll, to soul, to funk, all the way up into the 1970s. So he has this tremendously interesting career. Another figure who a lot of people would not associate with Elvis, but grew up really alongside Elvis on the Memphis music scene, is the pianist Phineas Newborn Jr., one of the great jazz pianists of all time. All you have to do is find one of his tracks and you will be blown away. It's some of the most stunning piano work ever recorded. This player grew up alongside Elvis, and they really sprang from the same seed because they were both Memphis blues-based artists, and they took their music in such stunningly different directions that, look, if you listen to some Phineas Newborn, you'll be blown away, but you won't hear any Elvis in it. But that just tells you how vital these roots are of the Memphis blues. Big Mama Thornton, great singer. She is the originator of the song Hound Dog, you know, which I think ends up being Elvis's maybe most famous and close to biggest seller of all time. Song that everybody around the world I think, associates with Elvis Presley. Go listen to Big Mama Thornton's version of it. The song was written expressly for her based on her unique personality. And start listening around to some of her stuff. She ended up writing a song called Ball and Chain, which was made famous here in the 60s by Janis Joplin, Big Brother and the Holding Company. And so Big Mama had this tremendous influence, not only as an R&B singer in the 50s, but she ended up joining the psychedelic scene in the 1960s and being quite bemused at, you know, going to these hippie festivals where everyone's naked and tripping on acid. She just likes to have her whiskey and her cigarette, you know. That's not her world. So there are all these interesting kind of culture clashes that happen in there. But the world of Elvis's music is just so rich and so giving. And those are just a few of the artists that I hope people can become more familiar with as they hear me talk about it, as they read the book and as they listen through this story.
Yeah, well, I've been inspired. I'll see if I can dig through the archives and come up with something like that before the end of the show. And obviously the book's got a big message. It's got a lot of history. It's got a lot of details in it. How is it written? What's the style of the book? What type of reading is it?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So, you know, I'm primarily a narrative historian, so I like when the characters develop and when the plot clicks together. At the same time, you have to have a certain amount of analysis with this story. And so you've got that layer of analysis that I touched on earlier when talking about explaining how the business, the intricacies of the business worked and really determined what happened with these artists and their careers and their finances. There are also just fun stories because, look, these are musicians. They're colorful characters. They got into all kinds of hijinks on the road. Crazy stuff happened. One of my favorites is from Big Mama Thornton, who was driving down the road in her great big, you know, I'm trying to remember the length of this car she was driving. Anyway, she great big boat of an American car, drinking old granddad whiskey, which is not the highest price brand, smoking her cigarettes. And my friend Charlie Musselwhite, the great harmonica player, was riding with her as they're going down the road and passing the bottle. And at one point, Big Mama kind of swerved off and smashed into this traffic cone. And Charlie sits up and says, Big Mama, you good? You want me to drive? And she says, why are you asking me? And he say, well, you just obliterated that cone back there. And she said, hell, I meant to hit that cone. So a big part of it is just, you know, getting to know these personalities, because I think that that's something else that young Elvis was drawn to. The book really focuses on 1953 to 1954. That's the last full year BE or before Elvis, because he made his first record in July of 1954. And he was in this extraordinary scene in Memphis where the radio on a daily basis had not only tremendous disc jockeys on the air like Dewey Phillips and Rufus Thomas, great live performers on the air, Howlin' Wolf, B.B. King, Junior Parker. He could just flip on his radio down and listen to any of these geniuses in terms of live performances. He could see just about anybody either passing through town on tour or just down on Beale Street. That ended up being in Memphis. That's the Black Main Street of Memphis that a lot of people know about.
Yeah.
Well, he hung out down there and went to the nightclubs and learned how to wiggle. That's where he learned his stage performance style. Elvis the Pelvis, some people called it. Well, he learned that by watching and later emulating Black dancers. But he was also a big fan of gospel music, holy music. And this is where I think he learned an important part of the type of man he wanted to be. Look, Memphis was racially segregated. Black people and white people legally were not allowed to be in the same public space, you know, without being separated. This great minister, who's one of the main characters of the book, his name is Reverend Herbert Brewster, was a radio broadcaster and a important influential minister. He went against this and said, look, white people should come down to the church and listen to the singers. And that's exactly what Elvis did. So he was part of this grassroots movement to integrate in Memphis via music. So that's another layer of the stories that are in there.
Wow, it sounds really lively and really interesting. The book is called Before Elvis, The African-American Musicians Who Made the King. And it's been written by Preston Lauterbach, who's been on air with us today. Absolutely love talking to to you, Preston. You can find the book on Amazon, on Talk Radio Europe Bookshop, or just pop it into Google. And if you'd like to get your hands on it, go and look for it. Preston, I hope that you have a lovely cup of tea. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anna. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.